President Callison, honored guests, members of the Commonwealth Club of California, and their friends. I am extremely happy to have the opportunity of introducing this speaker today. Modesty forbids my telling you now why I believe that his qualifications for the position which he occupies and the subject which he will address you upon are most excellent, and I shall not take much time in going into detail. I say modesty forbids my calling it to your attention, probably because Justice Homer Spence and Dr. Robinson are here present, and both of them are excellently qualified for any subject which they undertake because of the same reason that our speaker is today. And parenthetically, may I say that I also graduated from Leland Stanford Junior University. Our speaker today is currently the Senior Deputy Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs. And he wears another hat also, which is of particular interest to us today. And that is, he has been designated by the Secretary of State as coordinator of the Cuban affairs. He served in the State Department in Venezuela and other South American countries, and is coming to us today to speak upon a subject which is of the utmost importance to every American citizen. That subject is, as you've seen in your program, the present Cuba policy. I'm extremely privileged to present to you Mr. Sterling Cottrell. Mr. Cottrell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commonwealth Club of California, I have two very good reasons for being glad to be with you today. The first one is that it gets me out of that squirrel cage in Washington for a day or two. And if there are any reporters here, I'd appreciate their not misquoting me and saying that mess in Washington. I said that squirrel cage because being a Californian, I'd be delighted to stay here in San Francisco, but I'd rather do it voluntarily than involuntarily. Thank you. I say squirrel cage, and I mean it because, you see, the State Department is the cage, and we Foreign Service officers are the squirrels inside, and the White House is on the outside turning the crank. And they crank it so fast that we have to work days, nights, holidays, and keep from being flipped over on our backs. So it's a real relief to get out for a couple of days and talk to you. Now, the other good reason I have is that I want to talk to you about Cuba. There's a nasty rumor going around the country that we don't have any policy on Cuba. And I've been told that this rumor has been floated by some high-living, low-thinking Republicans, but I can't confirm this, and I'm not much interested because as a professional Foreign Service officer, we try to stay out of politics. Once in a while, we have to talk on subjects like Cuba, so it's like being thrown into a bird being thrown into a badminton game. But believe me, what I'm telling you today is not from a political point of view. It's from a professional working on the subject. Now, I welcome this because there's been a great debate on Cuba, and there should be a great debate. And it'll probably continue until 1964. And I want to clarify what our policy is. I take personal umbrage at this rumor because I happen to be one of the architects of our present policy. I also know, as does everybody in the State Department and the Foreign Service, that no foreign policy is any better than that that will be accepted by the American public. So if our policies are not right, then they should be changed. So I'm going to tell you what it is, and I'm going to lay it out very frankly to you. And I like your cooperation in telling me in the question period whether you like it or not. This is not built in concrete. This policy is flexible. There is room for change. And if you can sell me on a better one today, I can guarantee I'll present it to the President when I go back this week. If you can't sell me on this, on your own particular idea of how Cuba should be handled, then no go. So this ought to be fair enough, I think. Now, we have six main principles on which we're working. The first is that Cuba will not again become an acute, immediate threat to the security of the United States. That means missiles. Now, we went up to a nose-to-nose, eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with the Russians recently. They know we'll do it again. We've told them this. We believe they understand it. We believe they will not introduce more missiles into Cuba and present us with an acute, immediate threat. This is not an absolute certainty because these rascals can do anything. But this is our best judgment at this time. Now, the second principle we're working on is we are not going to invade Cuba except as a last resort. Now, that last resort could be one of two things. One, another acute threat, reintroduction of missiles, or another Hungary in Cuba, which would be morally impossible for this government to stand. The reason why we are not going to invade Cuba except as a last resort is that I and others who have been working on this affair, on the military contingency plans, I can assure you that the American casualties would be between 5 and 15,000 if we invaded Cuba next week. Now, this is a wide range. We can't be exact about casualty figures because you either have to take previous wars figures, you add in the factor of whether or not you get resistance in Cuba or whether you do. But the order of battle in Cuba that should be kept in mind, whether we like it or not, and however frustrating it may be, is that they have about 42 MiG-21s. They have over 40 MiG-15s, 17s, and 19s. They have missile bases, 24 surface-to-air missile bases with radar controlled, can throw missiles up to 80,000 feet. They have four cruise missile bases that throw out missiles from shore to ship, let us say, for against an amphibious attack, with a range of about 40 miles or halfway to Florida. If you get through this, you have a standing army of 75,000 fairly well-trained Cubans, plus about 100,000 organized militia, plus another 100,000 volunteer guards in Cuba. Now, in addition to that, you have about a dozen Comar-class boats mounting two missiles apiece, radius of about 15 miles. And these are mobile units that can be used against an amphibious attack. Now, these are the forces you're going in against. And those of us who are working on policy and look at this thing, I can assure you we in Washington are just as frustrated as you are here about this damn nonsense going on 90 miles from our shore off Florida. But the question we ask ourselves when we're putting up recommendations to the President or designing policy is, this is frustrating, but shall we recommend that we go wipe this nonsense out tomorrow? And I and others, many of us who've been in the war and put our lives on the line, and I'm sure many in this room have too, think twice about that. We're not cowards. We've done it once. And anybody in this room would shoulder arms and go to war tomorrow and make whatever sacrifice were necessary if there were an acute, immediate threat against the United States. Now, if it's mere frustration we're talking about, then I say no, and I haven't recommended it, and most of the policy people in Washington are of this frame of mind. Now, this can be argued. I've heard many of the other arguments that we haven't any policy because we haven't a timetable to invade Cuba. Well, I think this is wrong. I think that the people who are saying this should say your policy is inadequate. But not, we have no policy. Now, the third principle that we work on is that we are not going to tolerate the presence of Russian troops in Cuba forever. Now, this is a tough one, because after having said that, what do you do about it? You do either two things. You go in and move them out by force, or you try to make it so uncomfortable for them that, and by diplomatic means, push them out. Now, for reasons I've just described, we've taken the second course. We're trying to make it as expensive as possible for the Russians to conduct this experiment in our hemisphere. It's now costing them about $1 million a day. This is probably about the same bill we're paying to support Vietnam in our effort. But strangely enough, this is a drain, and it does cause strains in Cuba because the Russians aren't the most generous people in the world, and the Cubans aren't noted for being the most modest as far as their demands are concerned. And this is merely a guess, but I'm quite sure that in Russia now, between Castro and Khrushchev, there's a dialogue going on. Castro is saying, look, we've got to have more support in Cuba. And Khrushchev's saying, no, you've got enough. Now, we're pushing the burden of proof on the Russians by attempting to isolate the Cuba from the Western Hemisphere. And I'll describe that a little later. But the point is that we're doing everything except going to Cuba and pushing them out in an effort to make this thing not worthwhile for the Russians. Now, this doesn't set you up any nice timetable for the departure of Russian troops. The Russians first told us, yes, we'll take out a few thousand. And as far as we know, they did take out a few thousand. There's a question mark of how many they shipped back in. And I might say here that this numbers game that's being played all over the U.S. about how many troops are left and how many are going in and so forth, we call it the numbers game because it's fun to play because nobody has the answers. We don't have the answers in the government. We cannot tell you exactly how many Russians are in Cuba. The only one who can, I think, is probably the Russian general of the Soviet Expeditionary Force, and we haven't any copies of his personnel reports back to his home office. But what government figures illustrate are the best estimates that we can get by checking all of our sources of intelligence, both photographic intelligence and human intelligence and all sources. Now, we're challenged constantly by others who say, no, those figures are no good. We have sources of information that claim that there are 30,000 rather than, say, 17 or 12,000. And so the debate will go on. It really depends on which paper you read. If you don't trust the government paper, all right, you're inclined to trust somebody else. You don't know what his sources are. He may be right. But the main point, I think, is not whether there are 12, 17, 20, or 30 Russians down there. The main point is that they're there, and we don't like it, and it's an intrusion in the Western Hemisphere. It's a challenge to the Monroe Doctrine. It's an insult to the United States, and we don't like it, and we want them darn well out of there. But the question is, what means do you take to get them out? And that's where the debate really, really lies. Now, on the fourth point of our main lines of policy, we are not going to permit Castro to attack his neighbors. Now, this is the easiest one we can accomplish because with our forces in the Caribbean, it is highly unlikely that Castro could be successful in any kind of a conventional thrust against his neighbors. The fifth point is that we are going to do everything we can to prevent his export of Castro communist poison around through the hemisphere. And any of you who live in Latin America know that every Sov bloc, including Cuban embassy in the hemisphere, is a source of poison for that country. And we don't like it. We've managed to reduce the number of countries that in Latin America who have diplomatic missions in Cuba to five. There are five remaining, and we're working on them. We hope these will be reduced. There are about 10 European countries that have missions in Cuba and about 15 others. But we are constantly having bilateral conversations with these countries and with their neighbors in an effort to force them to close their establishments because we view them, as I say, sources of infection for the hemisphere. Now, the sixth point is that, I might say in connection with that, last month I went to Managua, Nicaragua, to talk to the ministers of government of five of the Central American republics. In an effort to work up techniques of putting the blocks to the Castro's export of agents, the movement of agents, funds, and propaganda through Central America. And we found no disagreement in principle whatsoever. So we sent a team down that's just come back a few days ago, having gone through each one of the five Central American republics to work out the mechanics of how we were going to stop this kind of business. And we have a pretty good chance of putting a real severe crimp in it. The way the communists operate, it can't be 100% effective, but it can be as effective as determined governments are to stop that business. Bilaterally, we're talking with other Latin American governments now on measures that they can take in the other South American countries to prevent this kind of movement of agents and funds and propaganda, and we think we can make it pretty difficult for him. Now, as you know, there are four camps in Cuba that are used for the training of guerrillas from Latin America. They're brought in from each one of the countries and trained and sent on back to their home country to add to the communist apparatus that exists in every Latin American country. Now, this is another dose of poison that's bad news for every Latin American country as well as for us. And we're turning our attention to ways and means of minimizing this kind of an effort. Now, the sixth point in our policy that we're pursuing is the economic and political isolation of Cuba from the Western Hemisphere. Now, politically, I have mentioned before this business of their political contacts through diplomatic missions and our efforts to reduce these. On the economic side, we've had a fair amount of success. In the 4 months of 1962, there were something like 435 free world ship arrivals in Cuba. Now, the 4 months of 1963, we dropped it to 85 ship arrivals from free world countries. Now, this is 85 ships too many in my book and in yours, I'm sure. But we're continuing our efforts to have our friends reduce that traffic. Some of them have been on time charters, and we have assurances from some companies that when these time charters run out, they'll take their ships out of the Cuba trade. Now, we've been doing that on a persuasive basis rather than on a fiat basis. Many people have urged, look, why doesn't the government put out a decree tomorrow and bar every ship and every line that has a ship that touches the U.S. ports and Cuba, prevent them from touching U.S. Ports or engaging in U.S. traffic? This is possible, and we could do it, and we could probably knock off the rest of the shipping quite effectively if we did do it. It raises a number of strains with our friends and allies, and we think that the end result is probably not worth it. Our persuasive efforts gradually will accomplish this just as well. And the end result, end part of this exercise, of course, is not designed to get the Russian troops home or throw Castro's regime out. It is to load the thing on the Russians. If we cancel out our Western Hemisphere contacts and shipping with them, it means the Russians have to pick up all the traffic. They have to pick up all the supplies, and it makes it harder for the Cubans to get spare parts, other necessary materials from Western sources. So that in view of the end result, which is to push the load on the Russians, we hesitate to take very strong, dramatic action, which doesn't really hit at the main objective of removing Castro or the Russians. But this is an open matter of debate, and you might want to suggest that we're going about it too slowly, and you might want to suggest we get harder nosed and tougher about it, and this would be perfectly fair. Well, these are the six main lines that I wanted to talk about, and I may leave a little more time for questions and answers than taking up the entire time on my talk, because in that way, I can get at exactly what you're after. But I'd like to review them for you again so you can keep them clearly in mind. One, you can be sure that this government is going to prevent the emergence of Cuba again as an acute threat to the United States. And we are watching it like a hawk. You'll have to believe in us. This is hard to put across at times, but they know it, we know it, and we doubt that they're going to do it. Introduce these missiles. The second is that we are not going to war with Cuba except as a last resort. Thirdly, we're not going to tolerate Russian troops in Cuba forever. Fourthly, we are going to prevent Castro from attacking his neighbors. Fifth, we are going to prevent his export of his brand of communist poison in Latin America. And fifth, we're going to do everything we can in the way of isolating Cuba economically and politically from Western nations. Now, this all adds up to a policy that is not as vigorous as some people would like. It's the best policy we know of to put pressure on this thing, cause strains, make it more difficult for the Russians to make a go of it in Cuba. But it does not, in itself, put a time limit on when we can throw out the Russians or throw out Castro. Let me say that this comes in the category of what some people would call wishful thinking. But we notice a great many strains in Cuba at the present time. Their economy is sagging badly. The sugar crop is the worst in many and many a year. It's approximately 3 million tons. They used to export up to 7.5 million. There is scarcity of many, many things in Cuba. They are still eating. The plain food is still sufficient, but there are no frills whatsoever. We get interesting reports from usually Soviet satellite embassies with the frustration the Russians are having in trying to get these happy-go-lucky Cubans to be serious about building a socialist communist state. The Cubans just don't buckle down like some of the more serious Europeans, and it's rather amusing to us because we have so many problems around the world with people we're supplying with aid to know that that the Russians are having the same kind of a problem with the Cubans. What they have done is to, as most communist countries, have grabbed the youth. They've concentrated on it. They've made a tremendous effort in the fields of education in putting these kids into schools, regimenting them, and disregarding the elder people who have either fled to Miami or are sitting around and complaining, but with no real strength. What they're doing in the economy is trying to switch from a Western-based economy to a Russian economy, and this is not an easy thing to do. They're cannibalizing all of their rolling stock, Western-supplied rolling stock. They're cannibalizing factories. Many sugar mills are out of operation because of lack of spare parts, and this means that the crop has to be taken to a sugar mill that's farther on down the road, and this in turn gives them a problem with their transportation. So they're gradually cannibalizing the Western-based industry there, replacing it with Russian and South Bloc, Czech, Polish industry. And this is not an easy task. But given time and given no interference, it's possible that they can do this. But again, that leads into the question of sabotage and covert operations and ways to delay and impede and make impossible this kind of a transition. These are things I can't talk about for obvious reasons, classified reasons, but you can be sure we're not missing any bets that we can possibly capitalize on. So there it is. It's not designed to relieve your frustrations nor mine in an early stage. We can't guarantee when this rascal is going to be thrown out on his ear or when the Russian troops are going to leave Cuba. But again, we believe, or at least I believe, and others with me who are making recommendations to the National Security Council and to the President, and they have been accepted, that we are not prepared at this time. We do not feel that the danger is acute enough to call for an invasion and send more California boys and others down on those beaches in Cuba. So this is my story, and again, I invite your very candid criticism, and I've told Doctor, that don't pull any punches. The worst question that's thrown up here, don't put it under the table. Give it to me, because if we can't support our policies against criticism, then we darn well better change them. So I'll see what I can do with the questions that you've put up to me. And it's a great pleasure to have been able to have this time to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cottrell. I am sure that we have appreciated the very frankness in the expression of your opinions. Now comes the question period, and Dr. Callison will present the questions to you.
I wish we had a lot more time because we have a big stack of questions here, and the clock's going around rather quickly. So we're very happy to have you with us today, Mr. Cottrell, and I'm sure that you will not pull any punches in your answers. We will lead off with this one. Will Guantanamo Naval Base remain under U.S. control in the foreseeable future? And does your answer reflect the State Department and/or presidential policy?
Well, that's easy. The short answer is yes. I know of no policy consideration to change the status of Guantanamo Bay. There have been charges, I understand, in the papers by some people that this were true, but I'm perfectly honest and frank in saying that I think I would know about them if there were, and I know of none.
As you might imagine, there are many questions concerning Guantanamo, and I think you've answered them all. Will we ever persuasively explain Kennedy's fiasco at the Bay of Pigs, especially in the light of Cuba's military buildup since then?
Well, you're going to think I'm a real coward because I was given this job as Cuban coordinator on January 1st of this year. And I wasn't there, Charlie, when they were going through that Bay of Pigs fiasco. Now, this has been debated back and forth by better authorities than I. If I had been there, I wouldn't hesitate to tell you what I thought. But I was not there. I only read what I see in the papers or in the past reports. So I'm going to duck this one because I can't fight that battle again with the little experience I've had on the subject.
Isn't one of your greatest handicaps that State Department let Cuba be taken over by the communists in the first place?
Well, here we go again. When did you stop beating your wife? Is that what it says here? Well, I don't know whether it's fair to load it all on the State Department. I'm sure we should have some share of responsibility because, as in my present position, if things go sour in Cuba, you can lynch me in San Francisco because I am one who is drafting these kinds of policies and then turning around and executing the policy after it's been decided by the president. So I do suppose, and I do know, in fact, that there was a great deal of State Department advice that was given on Cuba during that period. But I think there was a lot of advice given from a lot of other sources, so I would say that we should share the blame for this failure rather than assume it all. So, but from hindsight and from a frankly ignorant position on the subject, I can say that that it is it's a darn difficult thing. You don't know, for instance, I worry occasionally as to which one of these Latin Americans that we're now supporting might turn into a Castro, and if he did, where I would be on that subject. I won't mention any names in public, but you can probably think of a few characters that I have to deal with that have had a background that certainly wasn't Stanford and or the University of California, and you can't really bank on their loyalty to democratic principles. Now, these people could go sour, and some of them have. In fact, I was up a couple of nights last week without getting home in the State Department, waiting for some expected events in Haiti. This thing has moved onto the front burner and is bubbling over, and so we're wrestling with that. And one of the rumors was that four of the ministers down there were planning to announce a communist socialist state, and if Duvalier didn't go along, they were going to throw him out and proclaim it anyway. Now, this would have been a fine kettle of fish if they'd done it, and we were not prepared to see them do it and get away with it. I'm sure you'd be happy to learn. But it did not occur. But it's always a question as to whether a leader of one government or another might be turning for communist help. Now, this is not an apology for those that did not realize soon enough that Castro was a communist, but I just thought as a matter of interest, you might share with me some of the concerns that we have constantly, and they must have had at that time. I'm afraid I can't do any better on that one. It wasn't very good.
We have just one more I'm going to ask you on Guantanamo, and this question is, how can we get Castro to try to take Guantanamo?
Well, that'd be the neatest trick in the week, and if any of you have any ideas, I'd be glad to have them before I go back. The fact that this brings up another point that I think is true and I think you might be interested in. It's my opinion and others who are working on the problem that Castro has either by his own intuition or through Russian advice decided that his best interests lie in quietly producing a communist socialist state on our doorstep rather than provoking the United States into some action that will wipe him out. He's been too sweetly reasonable in the last few months about such things as shooting up or close to American ships. Been too quick to apologize for them. In fact, the Czech ambassador was in my office almost the day after with an apology for the last incident on the Floridian. And so we've looked at this thing and decided that this is it, that the Russians, contrary to the Chinese policy, which is much harder line, have been advising him, look, chum, if you take action that will provoke a United States response that wipes you out, you've got nothing. You better sit down there and try to make your accommodation with the U.S. and try to go ahead and build your communist state without provoking those Americans too much. And this is the way he seems to be playing it. So I would not expect that that Castro were going to attack Guantanamo. I think that he would realize that if he did it, he'd provoke such a hornet's nest that there goes his old ball game. So I wouldn't anticipate this at all. And I'll say it flatly, and if he does it a month from now, you can remember that that crazy character from the State Department was all wrong. But we have to stand up and be counted on these things, and that's my best judgment.
This one asks you to look into the State Department's crystal ball and tell us how long Castro is expected to last in the official opinion of the State Department.
Well, they told me you were a tough outfit. I can't tell you, and officially or unofficially, as I just said in my talk, don't know how long he's going to last. We don't know whether the efforts we're making to squeeze him in, to contain him, to isolate him, are going to cause stresses and strains which might produce an explosion in Cuba, which might cause the Russians to put him on such slender diet that the Cuban people can't stand it. We don't know. We're working towards that, and we can't give you a clear-cut answer on it. We could, if I could tell you that 2 weeks from now we decided to move in on him, and we were mounting an airstrike, which would have to be the first operation to clean out those missiles, and the second operation would be an amphibious landing. First you'd get superiority of the air, then you'd clean out his anti-aircraft missiles, next clean out his missiles, then blast his installations, the Army installations, and put up an amphibious assault. And we could do it, hands down. There's no question about it. We have the capability, and it's entirely possible. Question is, do you want to take the casualties we know would ensue? As I said before, I personally am not recommending that.
What was the agreement with Khrushchev following the Bay of Pigs fiasco, and has he lived up to it?
Again, I wasn't there, Charlie. That's a cowardly way of approaching this one, too. But I think what I'd have to do in order to answer this one would be very precise about the terms of the agreement, and then match it against what has happened. And I hesitate to do so because I'm afraid I would leave out a few items of that agreement. So I think I will be forced to pass that one. What actually, in fact, happened was that we believe he did take his missiles out. Now, there's room for argument about this again. Many people have said, refugee sources, that they are in, some of them are still in caves, and they could be pulled out and mounted. We know technically if they pulled out the IBRMs, it would be a real job, a real effort to get those pads in shape and get those things mounted and get them off the ground. And this, with our photographic capability now existing, we believe we're quite capable of detecting that kind of operation if there were any missiles left in the caves. It'd be a lot easier on the MRBMs, and here I'm maybe getting into the field, say, Bryce Wilson, the aeronautical consultant. I see him frowning. Am I doing all right, Bryce, on this one? This is our judgment that that they could probably mount those on fairly short order, and this would be a touch-and-go ticklish thing. But if they in fact do have some hidden there. But in the absence of on-site inspection, I can't stand up here and flatly tell you they don't. But I can tell you flatly that we do believe they have taken them out, and I can tell you further that we do not believe that they would launch these attacks on the U.S. at this time in this particular political climate. Now, this is where you can get your foot can slip in this business, because you make these judgments, you hope you're right, and if it turns out wrong, then you look for another job. So I could be back picking apples down in Aptos, California after making these judgments on Cuba, but somebody has to do it, and you have to review all the facts and look at these, look at the evidence, and make your assessments. And this is the assessment I've made, for better or worse.
I think you can answer this one very quickly, Mr. Secretary. Was there ever any bargain for on-site inspection to see that all Russian missiles were removed?
Another tough one. This on-site inspection is something that we have been insisting on. To my knowledge, there isn't a clear agreement by the Russians or the Cubans at any time to permit us to engage in on-site inspection. This was something we demanded, but it's not in a in any agreement between us. And this is one of the reasons why it makes it tougher for us at this time. You either go in and insist on your right, and that means going the whole way and pushing them out. It's rather inconceivable that they would admit us, admit on-site inspection, in the absence of a very clear threat to overrun them. So, in my opinion, we are probably not going to get on-site inspection. And probably when we do inspect it, if and when we got down there through invasion or otherwise, it would be through the application of our own force to do it.
This refers to a subject that this club has given a great deal of study to, and the question is the Monroe Doctrine still in existence? Is the absence of shipping occasioned by the breakdown of their economy? Two questions.
Let's see. On the first one, the answer is certainly yes. We who are policymakers regard the Monroe Doctrine as in full force and effect. The problem is, of course, that it's been challenged. And as I remember the wording, and Dr. Robinson can correct me, the essence of the Monroe Doctrine was that the imposition of any foreign system in this hemisphere would be regarded by the people of this hemisphere, by the United States, as a threat to its peace and security. Is that a close enough boiled-down version of it, Doctor? But at any rate, it has been challenged, and we are frustrated because they have done this. But the practical question up to us now is, all right, what do you do about it? And I've adequately described what we intend to do about it. So I think that might clarify, at least in my mind, perhaps not yours, the status of the doctrine. The other one is the absence of shipping occasioned by the breakdown of their economy. No, I think the absence of Western shipping to Cuba, if that's what's meant, is due in large part to our insistence among our friends and allies in the Western world that they reduce their shipping to Cuba. And that is the reason why, as I described to you earlier, we've reduced their ship arrivals down there from some 435 down to about 85 first 4 months of this year. I think as far as the breakdown of their economy is concerned, the Russians and the Soviet bloc are taking up much of the gap, not all of the gap, of the absence of Western world shipping, and they are supplying the Cuban economy with what it needs to function, and in their opinion, the minimum amount required to allow Castro to go on with this nonsense.
This refers to propaganda. With Cuba as a showplace, with their tremendous propaganda subversion and indoctrination abilities, will Mexico, Central and South America countries be able to resist communism?
This has a reverse twist that I'd like to suggest, and that is that that communist countries have rarely built a paradise wherever they happen to have been. And this could boomerang on them, too. I'm not suggesting that we're encouraging the development of a communist state in our hemisphere, but it is highly likely that it'll be extremely difficult for them to build first a going, viable communist state, and we're going to do everything we can to prevent it. And secondly, when they do get it built, it isn't going to look so good. It'd probably be a pretty shabby example for other Latin Americans to look at. In fact, there's some indication that Castro's luster has somewhat dimmed in the past few months. because of the missile business, and because other countries are deciding that this chap is not the second coming of Simone Believer by a long shot, and there is a growing sort of disillusionment setting in among many Latin American countries. Now, this doesn't degrade in any way the virulence or the danger of Castro communist agents trained and sent back into these countries. This is the real kicker on this business, and this is the thing that we're attempting to prevent.
What role will the Russian military units play in Cuba?
The Russians that are in there, or the Soviet bloc people that are in there, generally fall into about three categories. There are the organized Russian combat units that are in about four main camps in Cuba that are apparently doing nothing except sitting there as probably a deterrent to an attack by us, or possibly against the possibility that they might have to prop up the Castro regime against any kind of internal revolt. But they're there. In that capacity, there's a second group who are technicians, who are trainers, not combat troops, but they're coaching on the MiG-21s, the 17s, 15, 19s, the surface-to-air missile sites, the cruise missile sites, and in training occupations with the Cuban Army. The third group of Soviet bloc people are the technicians that are working on their commercial their industry and in the commercial field. On machinery and on their economy. And these are becoming more and more Soviet satellite personnel rather than Soviet personnel per se. So there has been movement back in all of those categories. Probably they've been, we think that they've been moving in more and more of the technician types in their industry operations, and have been taking out some of the technicians and some of the troops. But again, you get into this numbers game business, and you can play it any way you want to as to whether they've what kind they've taken out and how many they've taken out of these various categories.
How about the constant reports about the establishment of naval and sub-bases in Cuba?
There are constant reports. The last one I saw was a flap a couple of days ago about establishing a sub-base in Banes in Cuba. And to the best of our knowledge, Banes is a cruise missile base, and it's a base for Comar-class cruise ship missile ships, but is not a submarine base. Submarines actually require very little in the way of a base to permit them to go on extended tours. What they need is a harbor, some spare parts, and a few technicians. They don't need elaborate bases. They can come in and get these facilities and then extend their crews for a considerable length of time beyond that. So, again, we're in the realm of speculation. All I can say on that is that the evidence that we have at this point today is that we have no evidence on the building of submarine bases that have been reported in the press this past week. They are along related to that and rather inclined to be confused with it are the Cuban-Russian attempts to build fishing bases in the area. And they're not anything to be sneered at because bases for fishing trawlers are actually auxiliary parts of any navy. And present a very serious capability of being able to electronically and physically survey waters close to the United States. So we don't look on that with any great pleasure, these fishing bases. But a submarine base is not yet to our knowledge.
What is the scope and impact of Red China's aid to Castro?
Probably the most they have done has been to give him advice to adopt a very hard line, both with respect to the United States and with respect to subversion in the Western Hemisphere. They have not sent over troops, to our knowledge. They've supplied them with some materials, but it's been very, very minimal. Castro apparently has been playing the communists off against the Russians from time to time, and he claims he knows that the Russians are his only prop and his only source of supply, so he wouldn't dare cut his lines with the Russians by falling completely for the Chinese communist line. But on the other hand, he uses the Chinese communist line to needle the Russians on occasion, and he's playing both sides against the middle on this one, we think.
Still on missiles, how was it possible for Cuba to build up their missile bases in the first place with us unaware of it? And how can we be sure it isn't occurring again?
Well, as I remember the dates on this thing, correct me if I'm wrong, if anyone has particularly press people who know the dates have it in mind. I think it was on October 14 that the first prince came back confirming the fact that there were missile bases in Cuba. And if I remember my dates, it was October 23 when the president made his announcement of this fact, and I think it was on October 25 when we first discovered Russian troops in Cuba. Now, again, this I don't have personal experience with this, but I know enough about the subject to tell you that the photography up to that point, to October 14, had been intermittent and interfered with by bad weather. During the period of which time they had a chance to build these bases undetected. But when that flight went over on October 14th and found these things, bases and pads in place, not missiles ready for launching, because the IBRMs they'd planned to use at a later date than October, and they weren't technically able at that point, as I recall it, to have launched them the following day, say on October 15. So we did have a lead. We did pick it up. The criticism is, why didn't you pick it up before? I can't answer that. But I think the fact remains that we did pick them up, and we did take action to prevent their being used. So you might call it a photo finish, but the results were satisfactory from our point of view in getting them out and taking action to remove them. I think, as I said before, we will know if those IBRMs are mounted again, because they are. It's a complicated technical job in putting them up. And our photography, which is almost daily on a U-2 basis, and we have a capability for low-altitude surveillance when and as necessary to define more closely the targets, I'm confident that we can spot them. And I think most other people who are working on the subject feel the same way.
Now we're taking on the press. Do you feel the writings of Herbert S. Matthews in the New York Times influenced the State Department policymakers to sympathy and support of Castro, a support that ignored persistent warnings of the ambassadors Gardner and Smith that Castro had communist leanings and ties primarily through brother and party member Rawl and economic czar Guevara? Now, that's a good one.
Well, that's not too bad. there's an old saying that the State Department never reacts except to the New York Times. And this isn't entirely true, but it's one of the needles we get put into us every day. And if I haven't read the New York Times, the Washington Post, San Francisco, so on, before I get to my staff meeting at 9:15, I'm likely to get tripped, because the responsible reporters, let's just say reporters, who are reporting on this news either ferret out something that we have to reply to, or they've got news that's interesting that we may have confirmed a couple of hours later in our own cables. Or anyway, this is required reading for us in the morning. We get up, we've got to get that thing through. We might have a call from the head shed, which happens very frequently, with the president on the wire. Got my boss out of a shower the other day before he'd had breakfast on something he'd read in one of the newspapers that he wanted reacted to right away, pointing out a serious problem. So our press people do us a great service, and they have an effect on the formulation and the operation of a foreign policy. I won't certainly, from what I've read of the subject, and I wasn't there again, I certainly am not going to apologize for Herb Matthews. I think he was taken in very badly. I don't know how many people he influenced, but you can't gauge that. But it's quite possible that his attitude was bought by a number of people. And this is a measure of the influence of the press. If they're wrong and they give us bad leads, their advice may be very serious.
Now we're asking you to take on the Republicans. To your knowledge, did General Eisenhower, one, ever state his personal participation in planning Cuban expedition, or two, ever comment on expedition of April 1961?
No, I can't comment on that. I just simply do not know. It's the easiest answer there, and I hate to end that one on a no, that kind of a note, but there's a limit to the authentic information I can give you. And if I were taught anything by Professor Edgar Robinson and others at Stanford, it was don't bluff, tell the truth, and shut up if you don't know. So this is what I shall do in accordance with my advice and training.
You might answer this one more for us. Are you going to continue stopping rebels from attacking Cuba?
Well, I have a personal interest in this one because I attended a conference, I should say, at the highest levels in which this subject was brought up. And I can assure you that everybody in the government who deals on Cuba, including the top people in our government, have a great sympathy for anyone who has the courage to take a small boat and go into a harbor against a large ship. And you can guess who I'm talking about who might have a great sympathy for this kind of courage. And at that meeting, the day before these things were stopped, this was expressed, and we were told that all of us realized it, that these people are friends of ours. They're not enemies. They're striking blows for liberty against a common cause. And our only problem was to determine what effect this would have on American policy and not be swayed by our emotions. And we did. We assessed the effects on our policy. And time has run out, so I probably can't run over all the pros and cons with you, but I can tell you that an unbalanced decision, and it was a close unbalanced decision, was that it was not in our interest to have these uncontrolled raids on Cuban-Russian targets, raids which could produce reactions from the Russians and the Cubans that would require us to come in and clean up the mess. So for those and several other reasons, we decided on balance to not to do it. And that afternoon, I was sent down personally to Miami to work out the most painless method of stopping those things.